No, this is why there's no good political fiction on Netflix, because it's real. Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. This is our weekly roundup, where we invite a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they are changing the political landscape. We have a wonderful panel of Politicology veterans today, highly sought after crisis communications consultant, political strategist, and MSNBC political analyst, our good friend Susan Del Percio. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. It's so great to be with you all today, and I'm really excited about this panel.
It's going to be fantastic. We also have Lene Erickson. Lene is the Senior Vice President for Social Policy and Politics Program at Third Way. She also served on President Obama's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. Welcome back, Lene. As always, great to see you.
Happy spring.
Spring is springing. Zach Chakowski. Zach is back. Zach is a Democratic political consultant from North Carolina. He's a principal at Title Fight and the founder and CEO of Brackish Solutions. Previously, he served as a campaign manager for Katie Hill's successful congressional campaign, flipping a seat from red to blue, and as our political director at the Lincoln Project. Zach, welcome back.
Ron, thanks so much for having me on and looking forward to being here with y'all.
Up first this week, we are going to look at the results of the Republican primaries in the latest round of states and what the double-digit vote share for Nikki Haley shows us about Donald Trump's weaknesses within the party. Then we'll look at the latest impeachment hearing and whether the whole thing might now be backfiring against Republicans and Trump. After that, we will discuss, I'm putting this in air quotes, Christian nationalism and the people who think it's a smear and the only way to save the country and whether political operatives can effectively communicate around it. Then we will find out what other political developments our panel are watching and why. Finally, for our Politicology Plus members, we are going to discuss whether or not Joe Biden should debate Donald Trump. If you're not yet one of our amazing Politicology Plus members and you want to hear more from our brilliant guests, politicology.com/plus is how you can get access to everything we publish, and it's all ad-free, and you'll be joining a thoughtful group of pro-democracy listeners who help keep this show going. To level up right now, go to politicology.com/plus or click the link in your show notes. Trouble in the base. That has been the theme of Donald Trump's primary election results. And this week we have a pile of new evidence. Now that nominations for both parties are locked, the remainder of the states to vote can give us an even better sense of the level of anti-Trump sentiment. And this last Tuesday, we had primaries in Arizona, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, and Ohio. Now, Illinois, Ohio, and Kansas have open primaries. And we're not going to talk about the Democratic side because Florida didn't have a Democratic primary and Biden won about 90% of the votes in the other four states. Arizona and Florida have closed primaries, which give us a better sense of how many non-Trump voters there are. Haley's results in Florida were 14% or 155,000 votes. Trump won there in 2020 by 371,000. But far more interesting to me was Arizona, where she got 19% of the vote or 108,000 votes in a state that Biden won in 2020 by 10,000 votes. So 10x, more than 10x his margin in 2020 after she was officially not in the race anymore, but still on the ballot. But Trump's got even more trouble among his erstwhile inner circle. On Friday, Mike Pence told Fox he wasn't going to endorse Trump. Let's roll that clip.
Will you be endorsing your former president? You were on the ticket with him last time around.
Well, Martha, I appreciate the question. And it should come as no surprise that I will not be endorsing Donald Trump this year.
He went on to say he cannot in good conscience endorse Donald Trump in this campaign, so at least he's found his conscience on something. On Sunday, Pence accused Trump of walking away from the Constitution. And Tim Miller over at The Bulwark pointed out that other administration officials, in addition to Pence, who have raised the alarm about Trump, now include his chief of staff, John Kelly, who said a second Trump term would be fundamentally a catastrophe for us, two defense secretaries, two homeland security secretaries, two national security advisors, one of whom said, I just don't think he has enough of a brain to have an articulated view on U.S.-China policy. That was John Bolton. Three communications directors, and the context for these defections is that Trump is really getting a lot wilder. Here's some of the things he's been saying in the last week.
Well, thank you very much. And you see the spirit from the hostages, and that's what they are, as hostages. They've been treated terribly and very unfairly, and you know that, and everybody knows that. And we're going to be working on that. So the first day we get into office, we're going to save our country. And we're going to work with the people to treat those unbelievable patriots. And they were unbelievable patriots and are. Years, if you call them people, I don't know if you call them people. In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion. But you know what was interesting? Joe Biden won against Barack Hussein Obama. Has anyone ever heard of him? Barack Hussein Obama.
What's your reaction to Vice President Pence saying that he can't endorse
him? Oh, I couldn't care less. I couldn't care less. We need patriots. We need strong people in our country. Our country's going downhill very fast, very rapidly. We need strong people in this country. We don't need weak people.
Okay, let's dig in here. Susan, how are you trying to measure anti-Trump sentiment within the Republican Party? How can listeners start to look at these numbers more like strategists would?
Well, when you look at the primary numbers, here's the thing. It's a group of people who have not said, I am voting for Joe Biden. It is a group of people who said, I don't want to vote for Donald Trump and I want a different option. They have not committed to not voting for Donald Trump. And when I listened to the Mike Pence endorsement, and for the record, I was very surprised that he did that. He did a non-endorsement of Donald Trump. He did not do a Biden endorsement. And we cannot confuse the two. Not endorsing Donald Trump can mean he's going to stay at home and he's going to write a different name. But as we learned from our time at the Lincoln Project, we need a certain group of Republicans to go out and vote for Joe Biden. I think one of the Biden's big fears is that those Republicans may go third party and they will stay home. And those could be the margins. I don't know yet if Trump voters from 2020 are leaving him. Again, primaries happen all the time. You know, we see the parties kind of come together. Now, granted, Donald Trump, there's a certain sect that will not go for him, but they weren't going for him in 2020 either. So I think it's a hard measurement. And when you look at the battleground states and you look at how close it is, that's not Republicans walking away from Trump. That's Republicans staying with Trump. So that's what I mean. I know there's a lot to read into it and it makes for good fodder, and especially Nikki Haley and how she came out. But until someone of substance actually endorses Donald Trump and endorses Joe Biden and says, this is the fight, I don't see it making a difference.
Yeah, that's a good point. Lene, we've been watching No Labels closely, and Susan brought up the possibility of third parties. Last week, we talked about Jeff Duncan. At that point, all signals were pointing to, yeah, he's actually considering it. And then just a couple days later, he dropped out and said, no, he becomes the latest among a slew of candidates No Labels has been courting, trying to get to run on their ticket. He's now said no. It's unclear who it's actually going to be. But as you're looking at the returns and the exits from these primaries, and you know, the big question here is, how many of these not Trump voters now are going to be not Trump voters in November? But even more than that, there's a big difference between being not Trump voters and being third-party candidate voters, third-party or third-party candidate voters. So, what do you think about the latest developments on No Labels? Do you have any insights into sort of what their nominating process is going to be, who it might be? But more importantly, what did the exits, what are the numbers here tell you about the appetite for voting for a third party over voting for Joe Biden or staying home?
Yeah, let me start with the exits. You know, I think when you characterized it as an anti-Trump vote, I thought that was actually way too far. Just because you voted for Nikki Haley does not mean that you are anti-Donald Trump. It might mean that you'd prefer someone younger and less insane, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything about what your sentiment is towards him or what you're going to do in the general election. I think, you know, when you look at polling, you probably think that about half, maybe 60% of that Nikki Haley vote is just going to go right back to Trump. And I think, you know, there's a chunk that might go somewhere else, but I don't think that we should overread that. And I think the best example is Nikki Haley herself. Nikki Haley herself is making it sound like she is considering slash very open to voting for Donald Trump. And I think that's a good indication of where a lot of her voters lie. Now, if Nikki Haley does the right thing, the brave thing, and comes out and endorses Joe Biden, I think that would make a big difference. And obviously, that would be a real act of patriotism. But I don't think she's going to do that because she wants a future in the Republican Party. And unfortunately, she knows that that would make that much harder. So, you know, I think the Pence thing was so, I was also surprised, but it was so interesting because of course it included this false equivalency between, you know, how bad Joe Biden is and how bad Trump is, which is what they do when they're, you know, trying to hedge. They're like, oh yeah, I'm not going to endorse Trump, but also Biden is equally terrible. That's not helpful. And it's also idiotic. And he really relied in at least the news coverage on the TikTok stuff, which I was like, wait, this is what we're mad about? We're mad about the TikTok stuff and not about, you know, insurrection. Like, I really want you to focus a little bit more on the J6 stuff and a little bit less on the fact that the TikTok guy is now going to be a donor to Trump. Like, it was just such a weird focus. So yeah. I don't think we should, you know, be too excited about some of these numbers. But I do think on the no labels front, you know, we had a big win this week. First of all, it was a win that Jeff Duncan was talking to them in the first place, because did anyone know who Jeff Duncan was before that happened? I certainly didn't. I had to Google the guy. So, you know, it turns out he's a CNN commentator now, former lieutenant governor, seems like perfectly nice guy. But this is not the level of candidate that, well, I mean, there is no level of candidate that can win on their ticket. The math just isn't there. But this isn't the level they were promising their donors. They were promising their donors a high-profile person, not somebody they had to Google. And the fact that they're even talking to Jeff Duncan now, and now he's taking himself out of the running, and other people are taking themselves out of the running, like, affirmatively. Bruce Rauner of Illinois, former governor, was like, oh, no, I'm not running for no labels. I'm like, no one even asked you. So I think, you know, that is positive, because there will be a chunk of voters that are not happy about the rematch, that are interested in, you know, going somewhere else. And if there was a challenge from the center, I think we would be in very big trouble, which is why we've been obsessed with this for over a year. But if it's a nobody candidate, then that's going to be a lot smaller to contend with. That doesn't solve our RFK problem. It doesn't solve our Jill Stein problem in Wisconsin, where she's on the ballot and could be very, very damaging. But it's a step in the right direction. And kudos to the folks on my team who have really led the charge on that.
Yeah, you guys have been doing amazing work on the no labels front. Zach, I wanted to talk about these numbers in terms of two often confused words in campaign land, or at least in the media: depression versus suppression. Okay, so this came up the other day when Mike and I were talking with Sasha Eisenberg about his new book, The Lie Detectives. It's about how Democratic campaigns are looking for a way to adapt strategy to deal with, you know, mis, dis, malinformation, whatever you want to call it. We were talking about sort of the distinction between voter depression versus voter suppression, and how an attempt to get voters, some voters, some slice of voters, not to vote in an election can also can be an essential part of a campaign, which is not to be confused with an effort to disenfranchise voters from the ability to vote in the first place. And I wonder if you could speak to, based on these numbers, based on these exits, if there's a particular profile or slice of these voters that you think the anti-Trump aligned forces, let's call them that, ought to be thinking about discouraging from voting in the first place at all.
Yeah, so a thing that I'll throw out there is, if somebody votes in the primary, there's a pretty darn high chance they're going to vote in the general, right? So for folks that are voting in the primary, the best case scenario is probably leaving the top of the ticket blank. Not them just staying home. If you care enough to vote in the primary, you're going to find a way to vote in the general, generally speaking. But a thing that I want to actually go back to really quickly is, I want to talk about Mike Pence for a second, because I agree with Lene that his rationale makes no sense to me. Like the stuff that he highlighted, is like, really, like, that's the thing that finally, like, puts you over the edge. But I've been thinking about it a little bit, And I actually, and I can't believe I'm going to do this, I actually do want to commend Mike Pence for having the courage and the kind of the backbone to not endorse Trump and to commit to that. I think it sends a good signal, right? And so we look at what we did at the Lincoln Project, and we needed to have these legitimizers, this permission structure for people to walk away. And so while what Mike Pence's rationale is certainly doesn't make sense to me, it sounds like it doesn't make sense to Lene, there are voters in the Republican base and the Republican Party right now that might hear that. And they might say, okay, that's interesting, right? Because if he had made January 6th the central part of it, in all likelihood, somebody who's still with Donald Trump is just going to turn off. They don't want to hear about it. They're going to equivocate it with something else. It's going to be kind of ridiculous, but that's what they're going to do, right? And then another thing that I also just want to toss out there, the third party stuff, it is frightening because we're seeing, you know, going back to the numbers in the primary, there is a significant block of the Republican Party that would prefer somebody else to Donald Trump. I think I agree with what was said that that doesn't mean they're going to vote for Joe Biden. We don't know what they're going to do. I'm actually a little bit less worried about the third party stuff than I think most Democratic operatives are. That's not to say that I think it is more likely than not that it'll help Joe Biden. I think in all likelihood, RFK, Jill Stein, Cornel West, a couple others, No Labels, if they choose to move forward, it will more likely than not help Donald Trump. But I think that there is a world in which, especially when we see this level of discontent with some of these voters, that it could be utilized to help Joe Biden. And I don't hear a ton of conversation around that because unfortunately with some of these things, there's nothing that we can do to stop it from happening, but there are ways that we can utilize them to help elect Joe Biden.
I was just going to say, you know, the Mike Pence, where he was appealing, I thought was really interesting actually. And there was one part in particular that I thought really rang true. And that was when he was talking about Donald Trump walking away his commitment to the pro-life stance. And the reason why I think that's important is Donald Trump's been talking about 16-week bans, 15-week bans. I know he likes 16 better. But if you're pro-life, a 15-week ban is actually being pro-choice. They do not view a 15-week ban. And they barely view a 6-week ban as being pro-life enough. And with Mike Pence out there with that message, I think it's a different segment than we've seen than 2020 that could stay home. He has a powerful message within, and again, he doesn't have to take a lot, but with evangelicals, he can really kind of fine-tune that and talk about his commitment. And that hurts, I think, you know, when you need every vote. I think that kind of hurts Trump. I thought that was a stinging message he gave.
Totally, totally agree. And then going back to the third party thing, you know, how could we utilize that to help elect Joe Biden? So Donald Trump, let us not forget, introduced or pushed the development of the COVID vaccine. There are single issue voters around vaccines. I find the discourse around vaccines quite frightening. You should just get them. They work. They're great. They're safe. My wife's a scientist. You can trust it. But if you serve an ad to somebody who's a single issue vaccine voter who might be prone to vote for Trump and say, Trump introduced the COVID vaccine, RFK would not have, right? That's somebody that might have voted for Trump that now might vote for RFK, right? And so is that like, does that feel good? Not really. Is it legal? Yes, it is. And can it help people win elections? Absolutely. So I think there are ways to utilize a third party candidate to help the candidate you want to support.
Or they might just, you know, not vote. That would be a great example of a depression.
And I can assure you that Trump's team and Republicans are thinking about ways how to utilize those third party candidates too. And so I think while the efforts to stop No Labels are certainly important and should continue, I think that we've got to start preparing for the reality that some of these third party efforts are moving forward and we got to figure out what we're going to do about them.
Let's talk about impeachment. The House GOP's effort to impeach Joe Biden looked like it was beginning to collapse a little while back after a key witness was indicted for lying to the FBI. But now it looks even worse after this week. And I think it's actually starting to backfire on them. There's a wild hearing on Wednesday where Congressman Jared Moskowitz wore a Putin mask on his way to the hearing. Which might have been the high point for Republicans. Republicans couldn't get their two top witnesses to show up, who would have been Hunter Biden and Devin Archer. Instead, their two witnesses were Tony Bobulinski, who is a former business associate of Hunter Biden. He was a guest of Donald Trump at a 2020 debate. He was accused by Cassidy Hutchinson of meeting with Mark Meadows in a ski mask. We actually got a photo of that thanks to Jamie Raskin, who had it blown up for the hearing. And Jason Galanis, who is a convict who had to appear via Zoom from prison because he's serving 15 years for unrelated fraud charges.
But you're not making this up, right? You're not reading this from the Onion or something.
This is like real.
Like, I think we need to highlight that.
My notes in this novel, way too unrealistic, too cartoonish.
Not giving it a pilot. Nope.
No, this is why there's no good political fiction on Netflix, because it's real. Okay, so Bobulinski and Galanis did talk about conversations they had with Joe Biden while they were partners with Hunter. However, neither of them mentioned any conversations in which they spoke with Joe Biden about their business dealings. Now, on the Democratic side, they called Lev Parnas, who was an associate of Rudy Giuliani. He was part of the scheme to pressure Ukraine to dig up dirt on Biden. He was convicted on conspiring to make foreign contributions in 2022, and he has gone scorched earth on Trump and MAGA. And we have a clip of some of what he said in his opening statement.
From November 2018 to October 2019, I was a key participant and a witness to numerous efforts to prove that Joe and Hunter Biden were linked to corruption in Ukraine. Rudy Giuliani, on behalf of them, President Donald Trump tasked me with a mission to travel the globe, finding dirt on the Bidens so that an array of networks could spread misinformation about them, thus securing the 2020 election for Donald J. Trump. Ironically, when I was arrested, my original indictment linked me to an individual referred to as unindicted co-conspirator one. We now know this individual to be Congressman Pete Sessions, who sits on this very committee today. In nearly a year traveling the world and interviewing officials in different countries, I found precisely zero evidence of the Biden's corruption in Ukraine. No credible source has ever provided proof of criminal activity, not the FBI, CIA, nor the NSA. Even when CEO of Burisma, Mykola Zlochevsky, was offered a deal by Rudy Giuliani in exchange for information on the Bidens, he provided none, because there is none. The only information ever pushed on the Bidens in Ukraine has come from one source, and one source only, Russia and Russian agents. The impeachment proceedings that bring us here now are predicated on false information spread by the Kremlin. Everyone involved knew they were sharing lies. From Trump and Giuliani's shadow diplomacy, through my missions to Ukraine and elsewhere, to members of a BLT team, a group convened for the sole purpose of investigating and damaging the Bidens.
So that this moment was just like chef's kiss in the whole thing. Parnas also called Ron Johnson, your favorite senator, Susan, our guy in the Senate, our guy in the Senate, Ron Johnson. Okay.
It's so incredible how not newsworthy that is.
Too, yeah.
Because everybody knows. And it's
everybody
like,
knows.
Now we really know.
Yeah. Also worth noting, Fox chose not to take the hearing. They didn't air it. And here's a clip of Dana Perino, a host on Fox, former George W. Bush press secretary, after the hearing. Here's what she said.
At the end of this week, Congress is due to go into recess for another 2 weeks. And I do think that in some ways it just feels like they keep doing the same hearing over and over again. And people are starting to wonder, at some point, do you fish or cut bait and do something about a vote or not and move on to the general election?
Yeah. And guys, sorry to belabor this point, but for me, this was the cherry on top, courtesy of Jared Moskowitz. After he took off the Putin mask. Go ahead, roll this.
I think we should do it today. Let's just call for it. I'll make the motion, Mr. Chairman. I want to help you out. You can second it, right? Like, make the motion to impeach President Biden. Go ahead. It's your turn. You second it. No, nothing. Okay, we got nothing.
No, we got nothing. Which would be the title of this entire circus. No, we got nothing. You guys could see Comer's face as the camera pans to him when he's waiting for a second. It's a thing of beauty.
Even Jim Jordan is laughing about that. off the side. Like, Jim Jordan knows how ridiculous and funny it is. And like, that is not a particularly funny guy.
Question. What does success look like for Republicans here now? Susan, when officially would you classify this as a backfire? When is this actually doing net damage to Republicans?
About 3 months ago. That's when it started. I mean, I can't believe I'm going to do this, but and I apologize to your listeners, but I'm actually going to quote Chip Roy, and it kind of shows where this investigation went. He goes, quote, "I want my Republican colleagues to give me one thing, one, that I can go campaign on and say we did. One." Well, he ain't gonna get it because this impeachment process, it was so fatally flawed from the beginning. They never had the votes. There was some strong arming to let the investigation start. So you had some more moderate members from the Republican Party, or at least those in swing districts, who were parsed their words very carefully and said, well, I think there's enough for an investigation. But right now, as of today, those folks are saying, not good. Yeah, it's not going to come up for a vote. And now it's March. What are they going to say they did? They didn't impeach Joe Biden. They couldn't even politically have a win. So, and they delivered nothing legislatively. I was just going to say, so I think it's going to backfire greatly. I'm not too surprised I'm going to say this, but like, I think this is something that Democrats can use and say, you spent X amount of time on these investigations. It costs the taxpayers X amount of dollars and you got nothing. And I think that works.
Well, what they did get was this Parnas testimony, which is actually just beautiful. What I'm wondering, so Lene, you probably have a closer bead on sort of what's happening on the Hill. How much more runway do you think there is for this to go on and for the general public and the base to stay interested to the extent that they are interested in it?
I think people are already not interested. And I think the general public has no idea this is going on. Honestly, like I barely have any idea it's going on. And I work just down the street from the Capitol with Congress every single day. I didn't even see the Putin mask thing until you sent it in the prep. And I was like, well, that's beautiful. I mean, that's like, let's treat this clown show like what it is. But I don't think anyone's paying attention to this. Like everyone knows that it's trash and that, you know, there was never anything here to begin with. And so why pay attention to, you know, the Republicans trying to get clips for Fox News? That's all this is. And, you know, maybe some grassroots fundraising. They tried to, you'll remember that kind of the compromise within their caucus was, okay, well, we're not going to move forward with the Biden impeachment yet, but let's impeach Mayorkas. First time in history to impeach a cabinet secretary. And they didn't have any allegations of wrongdoing. They didn't have, you know, anything much to say except for, oh, open borders, let's impeach him. They couldn't even get that across the finish line in the first vote. And that was like their consensus impeachment. So I think like they can have endless hearings, but there's absolutely not going to be a vote. But what's the downside to continuing to have these hearings? They don't have anything else to do. They're not legislating. They're just messing around. And, you know, the guy who formed the sneaker caucus in the House is wearing a Putin mask and the rest of them are yelling at each other. And it's just like, it's like JV stuff here. And I don't think that most voters, most normal human people are like, oh yeah, I really need to track this story because there's nothing there.
Yeah. This is not a serious thing. Zach.
Yeah. So in my notes, the way that I describe this is dull, boring, and sloppy. You know, I think there's nothing that exciting here. Like there, you know, the thing about Joe Biden is like every human, he is flawed. But I think one flaw that he does not seem to have is he is not money motivated. And so the idea they're spending all this time and political capital searching for something that's just not likely to be there, it to me is a bad use of their time. And it's a waste of political capital. I think we should define for the audience what we mean by backfire. In my mind, I don't expect the Republicans to lose votes over this. I don't think that there's a Trump voter who's like, you know, I was with Trump the first two times, but then James Comer tried to impeach Joe Biden. It didn't work out. Now I'm not, right? But I think to both Susan and Lene's points, there were other productive things they could have done. There were things they could have delivered for their voters or for the American people or both in a dream world. And they just didn't do that. And so the loss and the backfire here is what they didn't do instead and the time that they wasted. You know, one thing I was thinking about, though, as we were listening to that Lev Parnas testimony, Ron and I earlier were talking before the call about Putin's network and how that works and how it's this sort of this pyramid of thugs, and one arm, you know, one hand doesn't know what the other's doing necessarily, but they know what the boss wants, and they're all trying to outperform each other and impress the boss and Putin so they can achieve their ends. When I hear what Rudy Giuliani was doing in Ukraine, it sounds an awful lot like one hand didn't know what the other was doing. They knew what the boss wanted generally, and were just trying to score some points. And it's frightening to me to think about how similar that is to the way that Putin operates.
You know, I want to just plus one something Zach just said, which is so true. And when you step back, is what's really going on here. Attacks on politicians only work if they confirm the thing that you're already worried about with that politician, if it confirms their vulnerability. And the reason that the Hunter stuff has not worked, we've already played this game. They played out this playbook in 2020. Do I think anyone in 2020 voted over Hunter Biden? No. And they're trying to do it again because they don't have anything else to say or do, and they can't deliver, to Zach's point, on anything else. But it just isn't believable to people because it doesn't confirm the thing that they are afraid of, which is that Joe Biden's old. They don't think he's corrupt. They think he's old. Now, with Hillary Clinton, this kind of stuff worked, right? Because mm-hmm. people thought, oh, maybe the Clintons are a little shady. I don't know. They don't seem to have that. You know, they were afraid that the Clintons, you know, didn't think rules applied to them based on stuff from the 90s. And then, so then when the server thing happened, it was like, oh, that's a confirmation of a thing I'm already worried about. I just don't think that works here. Like, they spent a bunch more time talking about Joe Biden's age. That would be way more productive for them than going at this.
Yeah.
I'm basically like a bobblehead right now, is like, yep, I was saying, yep, that. Just yes, same, every single one of those things.
Yep, yeah, exactly right. Okay, let's talk about Christian nationalism. This has been a major theme on the show over the last several months. There are other definitions that might be better in different circumstances. We've talked about Christian supremacy. David Gushy has coined what is my new favorite term, which is authoritarian reactionary Christianity, which I think is a better way to understand this wave that we're seeing. There's now a lot of pushback from Christians and Christian groups calling this term Christian nationalism a smear. And depending on who's using the term and what they mean by it, there may be some merit to that accusation because, you know, it's sometimes it's used too broadly. Here's an interesting point from Professor Paul Jupe at Denison College from a January survey of 1,500 Christians weighted. Among people who strongly agreed it was a smear, 68% agreed or strongly agreed that Christian nationalism is the only idea that will save this fallen nation. And of people who disagreed that Christian nationalism was a smear, 74% disagreed that it would save America. From Jupe, he says, Christians either embrace Christian nationalism as both smear and savior, or they reject those notions altogether. And this, as a backdrop, brings us to a buzzy video of an Oklahoma State Senator, Dusty Devers, which has been making the rounds on Twitter. He's speaking at a conference that has been getting a lot of attention. Let's roll that clip of Dusty.
Jesus, your warrior king, has summoned you. He has commanded your formation for battle. Line up, men. Your charge is to fight the king's battle with the king's weapons, to fight on his battlefront, to make offensive war on the gates of hell, and to prevail, to push the lines ever forward, to extend the dynasty and the dominion of our king who rules from on high, and every enemy will bow. Amen. He will footstool every enemy, and this world will be dominionized, and it will glory reflect like the waters cover the sea. The world will be conquered, and the conquerors will sit with King Jesus on his throne. Amen. Men, it is no time for shrinking back. Know this, you will suffer. You will be called to share in the sufferings of our King, but they cannot be compared to the eternal weight of glory that is to be revealed to you. In your groaning, you will grow. In your mourning, you will hope. In your struggle, you will triumph. So keep your eyes on our loving, crucified, but resurrected warrior King Jesus.
Warrior King Jesus. So when I first came across this clip, my jaw dropped when I heard the word dominionized, because that was a trigger for me back to a conversation I had with Dr. Matthew Taylor, where we talked about Christian supremacy and the new apostolic reformation. And he did a great thread about this clip of Dusty specifically. The conference was called Blueprints for Christendom 2.0. Now, Christendom is the realm where Christianity reigns supreme. And this conference had a talk on theonomy, which is Christian government, where divine law, usually judicial laws of the Old Testament, rules society. Devers has an MDiv specializing in biblical languages and systematic theology from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And by the way, he has a bill in the Senate pending that would ban premarital sexting. It's just FYI, single people can't text, sext, I should say. This is from Matthew Taylor. But make no mistake, the Reconstructionists are blood in the brain and steel in the spine of a newly insurgent and vengeful vision of American Christian supremacy, enlisting hundreds of thousands and even millions of Christians in their Christendom and dominionizing projects. There is a very real and very dangerous radicalization of Christians going on in the United States today, caught in the pincer between Trumpy, wild-eyed Seven Mountains crowd and the erudite, smarter-than-you Reconstructionist crowd. So I lay sort of all of this on the table because I would love, I have a lot of thoughts about this topic, and it's quite complicated. I think it's even more complicated to talk about for political campaigns. So the question I'd love to explore is, can Democrats drive a wedge between Christian supremacists and pro-democracy Christians? And what are the risks and opportunities that that prospect raises? Are they up for it? How would you think about messaging this or touching it at all, given the, you know, the complicated relationship between Christianity and patriotism in our country? Who wants to lead off?
I can jump in.
I'll just
okay, go ahead.
Go ahead.
You know, I think that what really struck me was, I think one of the things that spurred conversation about Christian nationalism again this week was some kind of sloppy reporting or talking about it that happened at Politico that more made it sound like anybody who believes that fundamental rights and freedoms were God-given is a Christian nationalist. And that is not true and offensive and super divisive and not helpful for Democrats to embrace that kind of a view. There is a huge, huge gap between believing that, you know, our constitutional rights were given to us by God and believing that, you know, this dude who's screaming is right about all the things he's screaming about. And I think we have to be careful. You know, I hearken back to the 2016 leak where, you know, John Podesta had some email that said something about dividing the Catholics. And it didn't really strike for me. I was like, oh, okay, this is one of 100,000 emails. Like, I'm searching for my own name in these email leaks and not like Catholicism. You know, I'm like, did any of my stuff get in here? But I went home and my dad is a Catholic deacon and he couldn't stop talking about it. He could not stop talking about how, and his whole, the whole parish was talking about it, about how, you know, how demeaning it was for a Democratic campaign to talk that way about their deeply held beliefs and to try to divide Catholics. And so I just think we need to be cognizant that, you know, about 2/3 of this country considers themselves Christian. You do not win elections by assuming or saying things that make it seem like those people are all one and the same, nor that those people do not belong in your tent. Because, you know, that's not the path forward. And I think, like, people already worry. This goes to the point about why the Biden corruption stuff doesn't stick. Like, this could stick because people already worry that Democrats are anti-Christian. And if we do things that confirms that, that is going to stick with them.
That's a very good point. Zach, what are you thinking?
You know, a couple things. So one for the listeners, if you're looking to better understand this issue, a book that I want to recommend is Jesus and John Wayne by Kristen Dumez. It's a it's such a great exploration of like, how do we get here? Because I think for a lot of us, you know, if you grew up in the church, you know, that Jesus as the warrior prophet or, you know, warrior king, it's like, I thought it was turned the other cheek. That's a big switch, right? And so, you know, how do we get from that to this? That book, I think, does a great job of explaining it. You know, I also think it's important to acknowledge every so often in this country, we go through a great revival or great awakening or whatever you want to call it, but people get more religious and it tends to be within Christianity. And I think we're going through one right now. We're seeing more and more young people kind of go back to the church. We're seeing numbers that are not in line with the recent historical trends related to faith and religion. And so we've just got to be clear-eyed that is a thing that's happening. I also think, and you know, forgive me if this is crass or off topic here, but like the guy who's trying to ban, he's got a bill banning premarital sexting. Like, yeah. What a fucking loser. Grow up. Like, yeah. Be an adult. Stop. Like, there's so many more important, like, if you really care about something, like, there has to be something you care about more than that. There has to be. Yeah. It's ridiculous. And so I think, you know, I think it's important, just like Lene said, to make a distinction between, like, the weirdos like that guy and normal, just God-fearing Christians that, you know, their faith guides them, but it doesn't make them believe that they should dominate anyone that believes something differently. There's mm-hmm. a big gap between, and it is not a monolith of a community.
Susan.
And especially politically, there's a big difference between talking about supporting people and their faith versus what we're hearing as far as letting religion dominate how you govern. And there is a big difference there. You know, the day I completely lost it against Donald Trump, but was just shook to my core, I remember because it was going on air, was December 7th, 2015. It was the day that Trump signed the Muslim ban. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like we have a leading presidential candidate that just signed a religious ban in the United States of America. And as someone who's not Christian, just as I'm in that other one third, it was just startling to me. And I quickly realized that Donald Trump is all about hate. And I think what the Republicans and especially Donald Trump and how they use Christian nationalism, because they use it too, is to create the us versus them, to create the hate. And the fact that we see it becoming so prevalent is something that just really, really concerns me. And again, I think Zach's really has a great point on we're up in the peak of religion right now in our society that we haven't seen in a while, as far as the way people are going to it, especially younger people. But this one just gets me. I have to say, it's horrifying to me. It makes me cringe to think that even a small group of people are part of our governance and aren't afraid to say it. And then it's being exploited by others.
Yeah.
So it just kind of freaks me out.
I do think we would be remiss if we didn't mention the gender aspects of this, because like this dude, he kept saying men, mm-hmm. men do this, because he was talking to a group just full of men. Mm-hmm. And the Jesus and John Wayne book does a great job of talking about this, but the machismo of all of this is that's the piece that really resonates with Donald Trump. Like that man is not a Christian. We know that, but boy, he likes the machismo. So there's this overlap there of gender politics and male domination, that dominionizing is going to be done by men to everyone else. And that's pretty clear throughout all of this. And I just think it's really fascinating to watch those things intertwine. Like this is the way that you can show that you're manly, is to, you know, be a Christian nationalist. And, you know, I think that's obviously very aligned with where Trump is in Trump space.
And thank you so much for bringing that up, Lene. And I think it's important that we say, you know, the men in those videos that are adhering to these things, these are weak, fragile men, and they have weak, fragile egos, and they should be treated as such. because that's what they're talking about has nothing to do with the core tenets of Christianity. It is an agenda. I also think one thing that we need to talk about to understand the kind of rise in religiosity, the answer to a staggering number of why questions right now is the pandemic, right? We went through a traumatic event as a world collectively, and it's leading to all kinds of weird and wacky and bad outcomes. And I think this is yet another example of one of those.
Yeah, I want to remind everyone also of the... This is not a fringe, necessarily, movement. It may be within Christianity. That is true. But it's also true that the Speaker of the House of the United States of America has a flag outside of his office that represents the Seven Mountains Mandate movement within Christianity, which is exactly that. These are the people, it's called an appeal to heaven flag. And these are the people who were doing quote unquote strategic spiritual warfare at the Capitol on January 6th. So not all of the people who believe in dominionizing America, in conquering the Seven Mountains and sort of ruling under sort of theological law, sound like Dusty Devers, okay? Some of them sound like Mike Johnson. And he's a whole lot less threatening than Dusty Devers. But I don't think we should underestimate their ability to gain power and exercise power to that end. So go ahead, Zach.
Ron, can you give us a little bit of context? What is Mike Johnson having that flag mean to that movement? And what is the signal and symbol that sends?
So it's become sort of a symbol of the New Apostolic Reformation is this group of charismatic, non-denominational Christians who are sort of like the outsiders to Christianity. These are the ones who have embraced Trump. And they're the ones who have sort of conflated domination of the seven mountains of culture. You've got culture, science, media, government. I don't remember what the other ones are. But essentially that Christians should sit on top of all of these mountains and rule by sort of divine right. This flag has become their sort of symbol, and it was given to Mike Johnson by one of the key leaders within the movement. So he knows exactly what it represents, and he's putting it on full display for everybody. It's kind of like, you know, Trump winking at the QAnon people back in the day. Remember that? Because he likes the attention. But Mike Johnson is a Christian supremacist. He himself, this comes up all the time. You hear leaks from closed door meetings with Republicans where they're like, this was really weird. It turned into a sermon when we were supposed to be talking about legislation. This is a guy who's mixing, not just mixing his faith with his political beliefs, but crafting law based on them. And I think this is a very dangerous thing. So it kind of flies under the radar, I think, because a lot of political reporters don't know how to talk about it. They don't know how to talk about Christianity as a whole, as a faith, versus Christian extremists that have been co-opted by MAGA. And to them, it is a fraught topic. But the reason I wanted to put this whole thing on the table and to talk about like how should campaigns should touch it at all, is that I think we need to be talking about it, and we need to find an accurate way to talk about the distinction between Christian supremacy and extremism that is on the rise in the country and people of good faith who generally see themselves as patriots and, as Alinea said earlier, as, you know, our rights being derived from God. So I think it's a topic that maybe is getting a lot of attention among people who use the terms too broadly, and not enough responsible attention by capital J journalists who need to be, I think, informing the public about the dangers of the rise in Christian supremacy.
Yeah, and you going back to the initial question of, you know, how do you capitalize on this electorally? I think that people in this country would be surprised to know how evangelicals feel about Catholicism. Mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. they would be surprised to know how they, well, not surprised, but I think that to hear how they feel about other religions, about the role of women in society, I think the best way to drive the wedge is just to let people know what they actually believe.
I do think it's ironic that I recall it was maybe a decade ago, Oklahoma was the first place that started to outlaw Sharia law, because obviously this was a big problem that there was a lot of Sharia law going on in the state of Oklahoma. So their legislature addressed this major problem by passing a law that outlawed the use of Sharia law. And now they're just doing the opposite. They're like, no, actually, yes, Sharia law, but our version. it's just mind blowing how we've just completely turned around. But it goes, I think, to the point of like, how do we distinguish here? We're talking about either the difference between legislating based on your values and your faith versus legislating for dominance.
Yeah.
That's what it boils down to. Listen, if I was a member of Congress, I would say, yes, I legislate based on my faith. My faith teaches me to, care for the poor and, treat others as they'd like to be treated. And all of these other things that guide my life are the things that I should be making decisions on in any job, in how I conduct my life, and as a member of Congress. That's a totally different thing than saying what I'm trying to do is make my religion the dominant one that dominates everyone else. And to me, that's the difference between Mike Johnson and probably a lot of other members of Congress who would say they are guided by their faith.
Really well said. That's. Yeah.
Really, really yes. Great.
Yep. I also think it's not enough to just call him MAGA Mike Johnson, because I think the Christian supremacist, like, it's true, he is MAGA Mike Johnson, but I think that we are sort of doing him a favor by downplaying or just not reminding people of this this view that he has. Now that we're up to speed on some of the big stories this week, let's turn to what you are watching on your own radar screens. Lene, what'd you bring for us?
I am watching signature gathering in a handful of states for abortion initiatives, because what we saw in the election since Dobbs is that where we had abortion rights actually on the ballot, where you could vote on an initiative, or where it was very clear, like the last elections in Virginia, that your vote for state legislature was going to directly either result in an abortion ban or not, where that cause is very proximate, people vote based on that. And the good news is that we have people that are trying to get on the ballot and gathering signatures in both Arizona and Nevada for abortion initiatives for 2024. Now, those states have something in common, which is that they could be the tipping point states for whether we continue with American democracy as we have for hundreds of years, or go into an authoritarian hellhole. So I'm pretty jazzed about the idea of getting an abortion initiative on in those states. I think it would help with turnout, especially in this moment where we're not all super jazzed about Joe Biden. I am super jazzed about Joe Biden, but it seems that not everyone is. And that would be really great. The other place that I'm watching is Montana, because the thing that Montana has in common is that it is also a tipping point state, because it could be the tipping point of the Senate. So I think it would help John Tester very much, and Joe Biden, if we could get those ballot initiatives on. They're collecting the signatures now. The deadlines are over the summer. So just keep your eye on that story, because I think it could be really determinative in those three states.
Totally.
Lene, let me add one more state, because Please. They collected the signatures, and everyone thinks I'm nuts, and that's okay. I'm fine with that. The state I'm watching is Florida.
Yeah.
They were able to get the signatures, and we're waiting for a ruling from the court in April, but Biden lost it by 3. Don't go by the DeSantis turnout numbers. He won by big margins because 900,000 fewer Democrats voted than they did in 2018, where he only won by 0.5%.
The hard thing is that in Florida, you have to get 60% to get that ballot initiative passed, but that wouldn't matter for the turnout point.
Exactly. And that's all I'm like super focused on and watching is that turnout. So I just wanted to add Florida to your list because if they get on the ballot, I think it's a game changer.
Is that your thing or did you bring a different thing?
No, that's not my thing.
What's your thing?
Oh, my thing is measles. I'm watching measles. Yeah. Not because I'm afraid of them.
Pro or anti?
I had my shots. The reason I'm watching measles is we have 58 cases reported as of March 14th. That's as many as we had all of last year. But guess where the outbreaks are? They are in Arizona, Georgia, Florida, Pennsylvania. Now, we were talking earlier about RFK Jr. and vaccine. This measles outbreak has the potential to start growing and making some real news. And I think adding to RFK Jr.'s candidacy and poll numbers, frankly. So measles, watch measles.
Zach, what'd you bring?
I'm watching two things. One is deeply serious and the other is deeply unserious. So the serious one is gambling. The rampant legalization and the way that it's being rolled out with limited regulation is going to have catastrophic consequences for young people in this country, for families in this country, and for the integrity of pro sports, which is an outlet for a huge chunk of people in this country. It's so obviously going to lead to bad outcomes. I cannot believe that we're just moving forward. All systems go. I mean, the Shohei Ohtani story, if y'all haven't been following, is absolutely insane. Now, for the less serious one, I mean, I'm watching Kate Gate, whatever you want to call it, Palace Gate. I was introduced to it by a friend, and then my wife was following it kind of passively, and now I'm the one providing updates every single day. Like when in the morning I'm waking up and I'm on Twitter, I'm trying to find out every single thing going on there. It's bananas. It's nuts.
What is Kate Gate for the majority of Americans? I don't know if that's the majority. I don't know how many Americans are actually paying attention. No, what is Kate
Gate? Way more people know about Kate Gate than know about MAGA Mike Johnson. Okay.
That's a shame.
Or impeachment. Or impeachment for that matter.
So Kate Middleton hasn't been seen in weeks, now months. There are allegations of a long-term affair that Prince William was having. King Charles is ill, and the extent to how ill he is, we don't know. So Prince William might be becoming King William. There are rumors that Prince William and Kate may be looking to get a divorce. The palace has put out doctored photos. Like, it's nuts. And also, all this stuff is on Twitter, and all of it could be wrong.
But does it matter?
I was just going to say, wait, there was a story about Russia putting out, like, bad information about the royals. Like, they have been like putting out like false information, and that's the only part of the story that kind of caught my attention is that Russia was involved. But like, this is conspiracy theory like on steroids.
This is to me the healthiest conspiracy theory, because like, there's no crazy action taken at the end of it. You're just like, oh, like I know I believe something that is misinformation, probably from Russia, related to this conspiracy theory or this scandal or whatever you want to call it. But also, like, you know, there's no voting for a dictator at the end of it. It seems like I guess that's the perk of a monarchy.
so it like it's like sheer entertainment value, or is this like, does this have any political salience at all?
No, this is sheer entertainment value. Yeah.
All right.
At least, well, President Obama did recently, allegedly, make a visit to Downing Street, and the rumors on Twitter from fake accounts and Russian information propaganda things are that he's there to negotiate some kind of deal, which is almost certainly untrue. But Obama was in England and met at Downing Street recently, and so I guess like maybe we could find a way to make it political. But I think it's just sheer entertainment.
A deal for what?
I was going to say, a deal for what?
Is he going to be king now? That'd be great, actually.
And that would be,
I'm for that.
I mean, we can leverage that to get him on the Supreme Court, maybe.
Oh, great. Yeah. Better use. Yeah.
Oh, man.
The alleged deal, according to talking Twitter personalities, is that he's helping broker, but like, he's definitely not. But it's still fun to follow this stuff. It's great.
Okay.
It's like Love is Blind.
All right. I had a quick look at it. I will tell you all in Plus when we get there. Before we head over to Politicology Plus, where can everybody find you, follow your work on the internet, Lene?
I'm at thirdway.org and on nothing else because I hate Elon Musk.
Zach?
I'm a weak man, and I'm back on Twitter at ZXCZ. I wish I wasn't. I hope that I don't see you on there.
You were off for a long time, and then you.
Yeah, and my mental health was better, and I was happier, and now I'm back, and it's the worst. It's Lene's right. Don't get on Twitter. Don't follow me. It's a terrible place.
Susan.
It's Kate Middleton. It's Kate Middleton. That whole thing. I can't get on it. But it's that conspiracy that's melting your brain, yeah. Zach. It may not be healthy for you to be on Twitter.
I think that's the only saving grace of Twitter right now, but maybe you're right. Okay. I can't tell.
Go ahead.
And I'm on X at DelPercioS.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening today. If you have questions about anything we discussed today, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Whether it's an episode idea, a topic recommendation, or just a simple note about what you thought, we love to hear from you, and we might even use it on an upcoming episode. Also, if you can head over to the Apple Podcast app and rate us 5 stars and leave a review there, we'd really appreciate it. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. I'm Ron Steslow, and I'll see you in the next episode.